Well, welcome back to the study of Proverbs. And we've been going through the book, and we're past halfway, and we're getting into a little further, a little deeper, through the 31 chapters. And for the last couple of podcasts, we've been grouping the rather grainy or granular parts of the middle of the book, which are the parts that people have the most trouble with, because they're kind of hard to navigate, hard to, you know, put into bottom line. You know, how do they work? You know, what are they saying? And we're doing that by going topical through the middle section. And we've covered a few topics. We've covered industry. We've covered speech. We've covered righteousness. And these things are, we've just kind of taken a 30,000-foot view and are skimming the book for what Solomon has to say on those topics, those ideas. And now we have before us the home. And the home, by this I mean marriage, family, and children. And really there's a lot more than we'll look at today on this subject, particularly marriage. The wisdom books would be hard to call wisdom if for some reason they didn't, for some reason they left out one of the most important relationships in the human existence, you know, the marriage. So we do have a lot more than in Proverbs than we'll actually cover. And some of it definitely is negative. That is, there's quite a bit about adultery. And if you were with us for the first seven chapters, and even going into chapters 8 and 9, you know that that's where most of Solomon's warnings about adultery and warnings about fornication are listed, are found. But there's more in other places as well. So let's look at Proverbs in that way. And there's some places where we're going to get a little graphic, so, not real graphic, but maybe if you have a youngster nearby, you probably, you know, want to think about how graphic. Because there are a couple of places where Solomon doesn't pull any punches. And the first one is very powerful and very meaningful on the subject of marriage. You ready? Chapter 5. Proverbs chapter 5. Remember, the first seven chapters are Solomon talking to the young man, and he's warning him about all the temptations of being a young man. And even into chapters 8 and 9, he then summarizes some of the things he's already said. But so this is in that portion of the Proverbs where it's pretty nitty-gritty. It's pretty rubber meets the road. Let's look at chapter 5. And we'll start with verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern, and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be yours alone, and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? Now, in the context, he has just said in the earlier part of chapter 5 that really there's a lot of bad things that happen when you go after a woman who's not your wife physically, sexually. And so then here in 15 through 20, what he's saying is, instead, what? What's he saying? It's an antidote. Solomon is saying there's an antidote to that tendency for a man to really be, you know, you know, from the fall, men are a little too reactive to the sexual instinct. We're a little too, you know, steeped in it. Just a little. And of course the culture isn't helping any. Our culture is really just fanning that. Just, you know, really stirring that up. So Solomon begins by saying, you know, don't do this. And then he says, here's what you do instead. So 15 through 20 is the antidote. It's the antidote to falling to be involved with a woman that's not your wife, whether you're married or not. Now, this is a very provincial thing to say today, but the Bible authorizes or makes real and makes proper sex only in marriage. Only in marriage. So look at verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. We know what he's talking about because we can understand the metaphors, but also because he's just said, don't go after adulterers. Don't go after adulteresses. So now he's saying, here's what you do instead. And what he's saying, what the antidote is, he says, is to cultivate the sexual relationship with your wife. And that will be a hedge. Now, he's not saying it's an ironclad guarantee, but that is the technique. That is the hedge you must build. Now, if you're just determined, you know, you're going to do what you're going to do. But he's saying if you really want to keep from evil, to keep from sexual sin, then you have to work at the relationship with your spouse. That's what he's saying. It's a very simple and a very practical thing. And in fact, I said earlier that Solomon spends a huge amount of time on adultery and fornication, and it's almost all of it in the section on youthful men, which is chapters 1 through 9. It's almost all in those areas, in those chapters. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. Let's look over to chapter 14. Chapter 14, we'll get away from the idea of sex and move on to other parts of the relationship. Chapter 14, look at verse 1. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. What's he saying? Is he saying women are a problem? Is he saying women are bad? No, he's not saying that. He's saying that a wife has a level of influence and a level of significance in the marriage, in the home, that you should not overlook. You should not minimize. It's huge, he's saying. It's huge. He says builds versus tear down. That's a lot of power. That's a lot of ability, for good or for bad. Underline that verse. She can build the home or she can tear it down. Let's see. I'm going to look at one of these here and see if I can... Yeah, okay, good. Let's go over to chapter 17. And we'll look at another dynamic in marriage. Another dynamic, all right? We just saw the dynamic as to the roles in the husband-wife relationship, the roles in the home, and in a very general, you know, 30,000-foot view, the wife's role and determining of what goes on in the marriage is not to be minimized. It's a very powerful thing. So chapter 17, verse 1, better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Okay. He says, you know, it's better to not have very much and have calm in the home. Or, you know, as opposed to having a whole lot. You know, you're wealthy, you're rolling in it, you're rolling in money, and yet the relationship is gone bad. And I'll tell you what I call that. I call that workaholics. We see that today, and we've been seeing it for a long time, that the husband and wife pursue their occupations. They pursue, you know, the things they're doing, their work, their jobs, and they do it to the detriment of their relationship and really to the detriment of the home. That's what's going on here. Because that's what he says. Dry morsel versus feasting? I mean, those are food, but don't think of them only as food. Think of them as assets. Think of them as wealth. Think of them as possessions. Think of them as lifestyle, your living level. Solomon says, hey, it's best to live at a very low level, if need be, and have a calm, loving relationship, than to pursue the really high level, you know, and you know, you got the fancy cars and the big house and all that, and yet you're not getting along with each other. Because you're working so hard on the money. You're working so hard on the things that you're not working on the relationship. You're not even there to work on it. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to say one more thing about the home. And this is in a very controversial chapter, chapter 31 of Proverbs. You know, stay with us, and eventually we'll get there. We'll get to 31. But there's something going on in 31 I want to point out. And that is, in the middle of the chapter, of chapter 31, it says something about the wife that is really, really interesting. So let's look at verse 10. Proverbs 31, verse 10. He says, an excellent wife, who can find? For her worth is far above jewels. Let's stop right there. It's hard to find a good wife. Well, I don't mean it quite that way. Let's put it this way. And I don't mean it that way. That was not what I meant to say. What he's saying is, when he says, who can find? He's not saying there aren't many good women. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, you can't find. You don't find a wife. You are given a wife. God gives you the wife. And you know what? He's saying something else, too. When you get her, you don't deserve her. You do not deserve her. Because you're getting something you could not have got on your own. Next verse. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. Verse 12. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. What's that describing? Is that describing a paternalistic marriage? Is that describing a male authoritarian type of marriage? I don't think so. And there are other verses in this passage where she's actually adding to the income of the home. She's got her own... her own things she does, you know, her own kind of specialty that she works on. And here it's a lot of it is making clothing to sell. And it also, this describes the wife as having her own ministry. If you keep on reading through this chapter, she's got her own ministry, and yet at the same time she supports her husband's ministry. It's fantastic stuff. We'll get to this chapter and you'll see. But here's the thing. This passage we just read, 10 through 12, is describing an egalitarian relationship. It's describing life partners. Life partners. Look at verse 11. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. Solomon is saying that he doesn't have to worry that his wife will spend money in ways he doesn't want her to. He trusts her. He lets her. Maybe in some homes you guys decide between the two of you, and every marriage is different, but every marriage has something like this. You decide the early part of the marriage, well, what's the amount of money I can spend without asking you? I mean, that's pretty common. That's very, very common. My wife and I have done that, and we've revised it over the years, and you know, we've updated and revisited it. But yeah, there's a certain amount of money above which, you know, you should consult. And you decide what that is. That's what Solomon is saying. He's saying the husband knows his wife will make good decisions. Yeah. And in the next verse, verse 12, he even emphasizes it. He says she's that way because she means good toward him. She's not competing with him. You got that? It's an important thing. How do we say that in two words? They're life partners. We could say marriage partners, but it's even more than that, because it says all the days of her life, she's committed for the rest of her life and the rest of his life. To be on the same page with him and to have his trust. That's fantastic stuff. It really is. It is really good stuff. All right, let's go back to chapter 4. And we'll look at, beginning here, we'll look at a few things about the children. Chapter 4, verse 11. I have directed you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. Wow, what's Solomon saying? Well, again, remember what these chapters are. The first nine chapters are basically, the first seven particularly, but even 8 and 9, are speaking to young people, young men. And even if you go back far enough, chapters, you know, the first couple of chapters, chapters 1 and 2, are actually speaking to teenagers and very, very young adults. What's he saying? Let's look at it again. Chapter 4, verse 11. I've directed you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. He's saying, he's the hypothetical father speaking to the hypothetical son, which is what he does for the first seven chapters. But he's saying, hopefully you've seen in me the model that I want you to live to. Hopefully I have modeled to you godly faith that you will use the rest of your life. And you know there's that saying that children are better caught than taught. Better caught than taught. And that's what this is saying. It's saying it's not your words so much. In fact, many times what we say to our kids actually ruin them because they don't believe it, because they see our lives are not the same as what we're talking about. Yeah, you know. You know about this. And Solomon says, look, you want to be able to say what this hypothetical father is saying to his hypothetical son, and that is, you've seen me live the way I told you you should live. You've seen me live it. I've modeled it. I have directed you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. Do you see? You can't do better than that. You cannot do better than that. Let's look at another place where he says it. Several chapters on, chapter 20, he says it again. Chapter 20, verse 7, a righteous man who walks in his integrity, how blessed are his sons after him. Does it say how blessed is the father who says things that have integrity, who teaches integrity, who, you know, gives sermons on integrity? No. What does it say? Who walks in his integrity? Who walks in his integrity? And that is what blesses his children. How blessed are his sons after him. Yeah. Ooh. Now let's look at a few more things about the kids. Solomon says several times what the parent's view of the mature child from the parent's perspective. Okay, chapter 10, verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Now, don't over-parse this thing. Don't say, well, there's a different thing for the mother than there's the father. No, it's just Hebrew parallelism. There's no distinction here between mother and father. He's just making it sound poetic, okay, by mentioning both. And of course, it is meaningful that he does mention both. That's kind of neat. But what he's saying is, what a parent wants most in raising their kids is one day they want to look back and say, oh, you came out good. You did good Because, you know, no matter what we model, or how we train, or even what we say, or maybe especially what we say, it's always the child's choice. In fact, there's a famous verse about that I want to get to in a moment. It's always the child's choice. Always. It's always the child's choice. We can put, in fact, I want to go to the passage that focuses on that, over to chapter 22. We can put ideas in our kids' minds, in our kids' hearts, but ultimately, they're the ones who make the decision. You know that. If you know anything about the gospel, you know that it's individual. There are no spiritual grandchildren. Every individual makes his own faith. Every individual relates to God, and there are verses for this. There's even one in Proverbs. It says, I forget where it is, but it says, no man can redeem his brother. Or is that in the Psalms? I think it's in the Psalms, actually. No man can redeem his brother, for the price is too high. In other words, your relationship with God is an individual, specific to you thing. And we would like to think otherwise. In fact, there's some aspects of the church, the real church, the worldwide church, that actually believe that children will have the same faith as their fathers automatically, that's a promise. No, it's not a promise. Every child will have his own, will make his own decisions, will make his own choices. And there's a wonderful passage that actually talks about that, and a little more, in chapter 22. And this is a kind of a difficult verse and a very controversial verse. But what it says, well, let's go ahead and read it. Just one verse. Verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, that sounds like a promise. But if you remember the opening, the introduction to this book of Proverbs study, you'll recall that we laid down the principle of interpretation, principles, there were a few of them, of interpretation. And one of them was, these are not the Ten Commandments. These are not promises. They are principles. They are general statements about results, but they're not guaranteed. They're not guaranteed. Well, let's look at this again. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, that sounds like a guarantee. And unfortunately, the English rendering of this passage has done some disservice to the church, because it's not saying what we think it is. It's saying something a little different. Let's take it a little bit at a time. Train up a child in the way he should go. Okay. There's been a lot of sermons that have tried to re-render that and re-parse that, and I think they've not been very helpful. But we'll just take that at face value. Train up a child in the way you want him to go. It's just simply that. Now, it's the second half that gets complicated. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it? Well, it's not saying that if you teach him Bible truth, that he will always stick with Bible truth. That's not what it's saying. It's not saying if you model faith, he will automatically have faith and he won't leave it. That's not what it's saying. In fact, the verbiage here in the Hebrew, and I don't want to get too technical, but the verbiage here is actually saying that he has a choice, but that choice needs to be chaperoned by what you do in his early years. You must put the wind in his sail. We're using a pile of allegories here. But you must put the wind in his sail. It's up to him how he turns the sail. But you must put it there. You must. And what it's saying here is, when in the first half where it says, train up a child in the way he should go, the two words should go is actually one word in the Hebrew, and it is actually choice. It's choice. It's the same word used in Genesis when God comes to Cain and he says, I see, you know, you have, that you're angry, and you have a choice right now to be angry or not. It's the same word used back there. So what it's saying is, train up a child in the choice you want him to make. And then it says, even when he is old, it won't depart from him. That's what the Hebrew actually says. It doesn't say he won't depart from the choice. It's saying the choice will never leave him. Not the choice, the opportunity. The opportunity to choose. What he knows to choose will always be there. He may always choose his lifelong to not be a believer, but he will never get free of what you told him. It won't leave. It'll always echo in his mind. It'll stay there. You might even say it'll haunt him. That's appropriate. You know, depending on his attitude. It'll haunt him. If he doesn't choose the Lord, it'll haunt him the rest of his life. He will never escape it. He will not escape it. The Hebrew for not depart is the same word used of David when he tries on Saul's armor. And David was little and Saul was big. And the armor was too big. It was a great big hulk weighing on him and getting in his way. So he took it off. It's the same Hebrew word for taking it off. So what this is saying is, It's up to you, parent, to put enough information, enough example, enough life lessons into the heart of your child so that he knows what to choose when he's ready to choose. But he still has a choice. And what it's saying when it says not depart, it's not saying he won't depart, it's saying it won't depart. It won't leave him. Even if he doesn't choose it, even if he chooses against it, he will never escape it. Meaning, as long as he's still breathing, remember, it's appointed unto man once to die, and then the judgment, I think that's in Hebrews. Every man has a choice, but the choice ends at death. And until he dies, he can make that choice. And he will have enough information. He will have enough example. He will have enough modeling to make the choice. But you've got to put it there. You can't trust the schools to do it. You can't trust Sunday school to do it. You can't trust the church to do it. You can't trust your best friend to do it. You can't trust, you know, his uncle to do it. You have to put that information. You have to put that word picture. You have to put that video in his mind or her so that when God moves him toward choice, he knows what to choose. He's not ignorant. He's not unaware. He knows what to choose. And it's because it never left him. Now, he still could choose against it. He still could choose against it. And even Proverbs tells us that. If you look way back in chapter 1, where it's talking about the definitions of the wise and the foolish, which is what we get in chapter 1, for the most part, you look toward the middle of the chapter, well, close to the end, actually. Look what it says. Verse 23 of chapter 1, I will pour out my spirit on you, I will make my words known to you, but because I called and you refused, and I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention, and you neglected all my counsel, did not want my reproof, I will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your dread comes. When your dread comes like a storm and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come on you, you will call on me, but I will not answer. Because you hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. The way to interpret this is wisdom is speaking. Wisdom is actually speaking. We know that from verse 20. Wisdom is speaking. And what Solomon is doing is personifying wisdom. He's saying, this is what wisdom would say if wisdom could talk. And he's saying, wisdom says, oh, you spurned me and ignored me throughout your life or throughout your, you know, for throughout your years. And then one day you find yourself, oh, you know, God needs to help me. I need his help. I need him for this moment. God says, really? All this time you've not wanted me. And even now you don't really want me. You just want the rescue. You just want the benefit. You don't want me. Do you see? So all I'm saying there is we know that man has a choice. Man has a choice. And depending on your theology, I mean, it runs the gamut. Some people say, oh, you know, no choice. And other people say, you know, all the choice. And there are a lot of us in between. But the point is, whatever your theology is on the matter of choice, the Bible says that we choose. We choose. And it's true of the son or the daughter in chapter 20, verse 6, or 22. Chapter 22, verse 6. It's true of that child. But it's up to us, the parent, to make sure that he has the option. To make sure that when his heart is moving toward, and it's God that does this, it's the Holy Spirit that does this, we know that. But when his heart is beginning to move and ebb toward, you know, making the choice, that he knows what that choice is. You can't automatically say, oh yeah, you know, automatically, he's been to Sunday school, he's, you know, he's been to church. No. No, that won't do it. He has to know chapter and verse. He has to know the gospel in as clear and as pointedly a manner as you can do it, as you can make it. Then he'll know what to choose. Make sense? Well, we spent quite a bit of time on the home. I think next time we'll get into a really, really interesting topic, and that is leadership. And it's a very timely topic because in our culture today, in the West especially, but all over the world, we're seeing a huge change in the respect for leadership because leadership has just crumbled all over the world. It's just crumbled. It's deteriorated until it's nothing. There's not even manlyhood anymore in the world. It's terrible. But not to get political. But we'll see what leadership looks like in Proverbs, what Solomon says about Proverbs. In Proverbs about leadership. And I think you'll be be built up by seeing that. Anyway, so I hope this has been useful to you, and I hope that it builds your faith, not your head, and that it draws you toward the one who loves you most. And in the meantime, believe God.